today on Against the Grain. Working class blue collar folks aren't often thought of as serious readers, radical thinkers, or people open to other cultures and ways of life. But according to James Barrett, working class culture may have been far more vibrant and cosmopolitan than we think. I'm CS. I'll talk with the University of Illinois historian about his book, History from the Bottom Up and the Inside Out, Ethnicity, Race, and Identity in Working Class History, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Intellectualism and cosmopolitanism aren't things typically associated with working-class communities. We don't tend to think of blue-collar workers as returning home from often physically demanding jobs to read books and engage with political ideas and, in some instances, to delve into radical political texts. But James Barrett has investigated and unearthed highly literate and often quite radical working-class cultures, cultures in which people read widely, gathered for discussions, and in some cases traveled a great deal, learning about other people and other cultures and countries. Blue-collar cosmopolitans is the name Barrett has given to certain categories or types of people, people he describes in his latest book, History from the Bottom Up and the Inside Out, Ethnicity, Race, and Identity in Working Class History. James Barrett is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. When he joined me recently by phone, Jim began with these remarks about the focus of, especially, the chapter in his book about blue-collar cosmopolitans. And I should say that Antonio Gramsci, whom Jim refers to, was an Italian Marxist theorist.
I'm interested in the people who Gramsci would have called organic intellectuals, in other words, working class intellectuals that became an important part of radical working class movements. I'm interested in those people, and they play a role in this essay that we're talking about. But I'm also interested in the phenomenon more generally. I think that most historians, even working class historians, have probably underestimated the relative sophistication of a lot of working class people, sophistication in terms of reading and ideas, but also in terms of travel, familiarity with the world more generally. Those are the kind of things that historians and philosophers talk about a lot when they use this term cosmopolitan. And I think there were more traces of that in working class culture than a lot of historians have probably recognized.
Tell me more about the term cosmopolitan and what it means and what you mean when you use the term.
You know, it comes from a couple of Greek terms. One is cosmos, meaning just the world or the universe, and then politos, which often means citizen. And so when you hear this phrase, citizen of the world, when people use that phrase, they're often talking about cosmopolitanism is kind of a phenomena. So some of the sophistication that I'm talking about comes from a familiarity with other peoples, other parts of the world, but also with ideas kind of broadly defined. In other words, a familiarity with kind of a broad set of ideas, and often international in terms of its perspective. So very clear, one might say extreme examples of that would be anarchist or communist militants who kind of by definition took a global view of politics, of course, but, you know, of people more generally, and were often mixing with people from very different sorts of backgrounds. One other category of people that might qualify, depending on how you use this definition, would simply be many immigrants who, ironically, are often thought of as kind of narrow in their view and in their experience. But a lot of them, either in the old world or in transition to the new world and living in working class communities, actually came in contact with a lot of different sorts of people, experienced parts of the world better, I might say, than a lot of middle class and educated people would. So the project here is partly trying to, if not blow up, at least expand the understandings of the term and extending it to people, workers in particular, who might, readers and people that were interested in this might not automatically connect with the term.
So what was happening at the, you know, in the late 19th century and the early 20th century that allowed people to read more widely and travel more easily and therefore be perhaps more likely to adopt a cosmopolitan outlook?
So this term globalism is used a lot today, sometimes I think kind of uncritically. But this is a period, and incidentally I'm talking particularly about the period of the late 19th century and then the early 20th century. So some of this is material in character and more concrete and maybe more straightforward. So the expansion of market systems internationally and then the technology that was required to move not only goods but also people internationally goes through a striking development in the late 19th, early 20th century. So for moving people and goods, you know, that's part of the context. But there's also kind of an explosion of texts of all different sorts. Some of these are working class newspapers, foreign language newspapers, regular mainstream daily press. Some of it consists of political tracts. And at the same time, and also kind of driving this expansion of printed texts, is an expansion of literacy. Some of that has to do with, in the United States, with an expansion of public education, a restriction of child labor so that working class people are not necessarily leaving school as early as they might have otherwise. So you get on the one hand an expansion of education, literacy, and on the other hand, you still have people leaving school before they've probably learned everything that they would like to learn. And so into that vacuum, you get the development of a lot of these popular presses. There's these wonderful little Haldeman Julius books that were carefully designed to fit into overalls and work clothes, but on a bewildering sort of array of subjects. And some of the stuff is radical, and some of it is just philosophies, Confucianism, Buddhism, stuff on human sexuality, a lot of different sorts of topics that a reader who might not have had a lot of formal education but was curious, intellectually curious, would be able to turn to. And it's in this period that I'm most interested in, the late 19th and early 20th century, when a lot of other things are happening, mass immigration, expansion of mass production technology, you know, the need for labor, even unskilled labor in the U.S., it's at the same time that a lot of that is happening that I think you get, you know, kind of a blossoming of working class intellectual curiosity.
His name is James Barrett. He's professor emeritus of history at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, and he is the author of, among other books, History from the Bottom Up and the Inside Out, Ethnicity, Race, and Identity in Working Class History. And we are talking about a section of that book about what he calls blue-collar cosmopolitans, and we'll obviously flesh that term out more as we go along. One category, I mean, what you do in this chapter that we were talking about is you bring up a set of archetypes, and, you know, there's overlap to some degree among at least some of them, but I find the archetypes, the categories, pretty fascinating. So, for example, the first one you bring up in this chapter, again, as an example of a blue-collar cosmopolitan, are hobos. And hobos, as I understand it, were often migrants, labor migrants. They were moving with the trains, with the seasons, to find work. How important was travel to the ability of hobos to expand their knowledge and their awareness?
So this is another case, hobos, and especially the large number of migratory laborers among that population, where work itself necessitates movement, you know, travel, contact with different peoples. So it's partly a matter of geography. So hobos, ironically, probably saw a lot more of the United States than many middle-class people doing white-collar work and more firmly rooted in a particular community. The hobos may actually have seen a lot more of the country and come in contact with more sorts of people, observed more kinds of culture than other people would. And the kind of built-in irony is that these are workers that most people, even today, I think, would consider unskilled, indeed, you know, kind of rootless, in other words, part of no particular community. But both at the workplace in a wheat harvest or other kinds of migratory agricultural work, or laying low in a casual labor kind of a city. Chicago would be an example of that, but on the West Coast, San Francisco would be another example. They actually did a lot of reading. Many of them did, at least, not all of them, but and came in contact with, you know, people that I would consider genuine intellectuals, people who got interested in political ideology, but also diverse cultures and so forth. And this knowledge, this understanding, gets exchanged on the train among, you know, within the hobo culture and in hobo jungles, and also at work. So it's kind of a nice example, because what category of person might be considered kind of lower in the social hierarchy than the hobo, and yet people who have taken the time to look at the lives of these workers find over and over again, you know, a genuine intellectual curiosity, a lot of reading, and then, of course, as I mentioned, as I started, with a lot of travel, obviously, by definition.
Yeah, and when you said some hobos came into contact with who you would consider to be intellectuals, you mean fellow hobos, right? You don't mean they went to night school necessarily, although they might have if they settled in one place for a certain amount of time. But these are fellow hobos, and I would imagine that the kinds of people hobos came into contact with, fellow hobos, is it kind of by definition that they would be nonconformists, that they'd have a very different outlook and attitude than people who adhered to mainstream values?
Right. So some of these hobos, you know, at least to some extent, are traveling by necessity, that is, to find work. But people who have taken a look at them, there was a sociologist at the University of Chicago in the 20s who looked kind of carefully at the culture, met a lot of the people, and in fact was a participant observer. In other words, he started out as a hobo and continued to do some hoboing as he did his research and writing. And what he argues is that there's also kind of a subclass within the hobo population of people who are doing this quite voluntarily, people who, you know, don't want to spend each workday sitting in an office or working in a factory, and instead do their work as they go along and move outside of mainstream culture, to the point that hobos, of course, were feared in some communities precisely because they are people kind of at the margins of society. But as you suggested in the question, sometimes that fits rather well with you know, a broad interest in ideas, and openness to ideas that more settled, sometimes even better educated people, you know, might have lacked. The one other thing that I was going to mention is that there were actually some academics who recognized this as kind of a fascinating culture and would sometimes invite hobos into their classes. And the juxtaposition between more typical intellectuals, you know, students and professors on the one hand, and these sometimes very well-read, kind of sophisticated working-class characters, the hobos, you know, often led to kind of comic confrontations between people who were convinced by virtue of their education that they were very bright and very cosmopolitan in many ways, and the hobos who they assumed were not and sometimes turn out to be after all.
How prominent was the wobbly, the radical wobbly culture, the industrial workers of the world culture among itinerant workers, including hobos?
So on the one hand, by definition, we don't have very good statistics on how common it was, but we do know that the IWW, on the one hand, hopes to explain some of this radicalism that we see among hobos. In other words, that they were providing sort of a conduit between that culture and radical political organization, on the other hand. But the IWW, to some extent, recognized some of these characteristics that we're talking about. And the IWW culture then was adapted to that. So it took into account mobility, you know, and addressed some of the real serious issues that migratory workers were facing on the job, you know, health issues, and, you know, the thousands of people that were killed on trains while trying to travel on them. So they addressed themselves to that culture. They adapted their propaganda to that. The songs and music is a part of that. You know, it was a way of approaching workers with or without much literacy. And again, the numbers are not real clear because some of the influences were more sort of amorphous. In other words, not every radical hobo joined the IWW. But it is clear from the IWW membership figures, high, for example, in the period of the First World War, that this was an important part of the hobo culture, and the hobos were an important part of the membership base of the IWW.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. James Barrett joins me. He's Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. The figure of the immigrant, you brought this up earlier, the person of the immigrant was another kind of blue-collar cosmopolitan, in your view. How striking was the movement of immigrants to the U.S. in the late 19th and early 20th centuries?
So this period of the late 19th and early 20th century is the period of truly mass immigration. Just to take sort of a benchmark, the year 1907, which saw an immigration of well over 3 million people within that 1 year, was the high water mark for that period. But there were millions of people coming throughout that period. And one of the things that happens is that the old world culture, elements of literacy and musical culture and theater culture, the immigrants bring with them to some extent. So you find cultures like the German working class cultures in many cities, especially in the Midwest, but also in New York, characterized by a lot of live theater, music, choral groups. These are working class people that I'm talking about now, reading groups, you know, and of course political organizations, but not only explicitly political organizations, also a sort of real blossoming of culture. And then the example that is most often taken up is the example of the Lower East Side in New York, which was a heavily Yiddish culture. Again, a lot of live Yiddish theater, many publications in the language, the Yiddish language, that Jewish immigrants from a lot of different countries and nations and societies in Europe would have been able to read, you know, that proliferating in the neighborhood. And then wonderful descriptions of how in these immigrant neighborhoods you wouldn't necessarily have to be literate because of a lot of the political discussion and propaganda and so forth was carried on in the streets. You know, soapboxers that would turn over a box and get up on it on a busy corner and attract people by speaking. And there were a lot of brilliant speakers. Some of them we know about, like Emma Goldman, the anarchist radical and political activist and intellectual, who incidentally had not very much formal education, but, you know, was very widely read, was one of these soapboxers. But then there's who knows how many anonymous speakers on corners throughout, not just New York, but in the immigrant ghettos in various cities around the United States. So immigration was a very big part of this. The fact that the radical organizations, we mentioned the IWW earlier, but the Socialist Party and eventually the Communist Party did a lot of their recruiting among immigrants is partly explained by the ubiquity of immigrant workers throughout American society during this period. But it's also explained in part by this phenomena of working class intellectuals that I'm trying to describe. It was precisely among such people that the radical organizations would have recruited. And incidentally, what's true of the immigrant cultures, many of the immigrant cultures in this period, is also true to some degree of the black migrants who made their way to northern cities, industrial towns, in precisely these same years. And certainly there were parallels to be drawn between the immigrant culture and the sort of cultures that black migrants created in Harlem in particular, which is the example that everyone always thinks about, but also in other cities. Chicago had a kind of renaissance in roughly the same period that people talk about the Harlem Renaissance.
And we think of immigrants sometimes in the context of homogeneous immigrant communities or enclaves in cities like New York City. How prevalent was contact between, let's say, arriving immigrants and other immigrants from other countries with other ethnicities? And I guess I'm asking here about a kind of interethnic, multi-ethnic mixing, which I imagine would also spur a kind of cosmopolitan, further spur a kind of cosmopolitan consciousness.
So you can dig into that question about contact between the various ethnic and racial groups at a lot of different points. There are some kind of extreme examples. So technically, the Yiddish culture that I'm talking about, by definition, meant crossing all kinds of ethnic divisions. So the Jewish immigrants that wound up on the Lower East Side came from all over the place. A lot of them came from Russia, of course, but many came from Romania, Poland, what's now the Czech Republic. All these countries in Eastern Europe had fairly large Jewish populations, and what allowed people from the different nationalities, Jewish people from the different nationalities to come together was to a large degree this common language. So the point, of course, is that that's not the only example of that. So if you go to the cigar workers culture down in Florida, especially Tampa, there was a lot of interaction among Cuban workers, Cuban cigar industry workers, Spanish immigrant workers who worked in the cigar industry, including a lot of anarchists, Spanish anarchists, and Italian workers. So you could get a kind of interethnic working class culture that could develop in those kinds of settings. Something like that happened among the Scandinavian immigrant workers who came, some with politics, some without, but the languages were sometimes close enough that it allowed for interaction among those Scandinavian groups. And in other cases, you know, people that just picked up English a little bit more quickly than some other immigrant people might have. So there's been a shift among immigration historians. There was a long, great generation of work that sort of lovingly recreated these various, you know, more or less distinct immigrant ethnic cultures that developed in cities across the country. But more recently, people have become interested in this kind of interethnic contact that you were asking about. And they've also shown greater interest than they did earlier on of how, for want of a better phrase, it's an awkward, contested kind of terrain, but for want of a better phrase, how immigrant people became American, quote unquote. And there was an acculturation, obviously, that took place even within the immigrant generation, but especially across generations. And so the urban cultures that we wind up with, maybe as early as the Depression, but certainly by the World War II and post-World War II period, are by definition interethnic, and people begin to intermarry more than they did earlier on. You know, that's to some degree what makes the United States, if not unique, kind of unusual. So all that sort of fermentation and interethnic contact is going on in cities, and it's, for me at least, it's one of the things that makes, you know, studying the urban culture that begins to develop, you know, kind of exciting.
He's James Barrett. He is Professor Emeritus of History at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His books include The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City, and William Z. Foster and the Tragedy of American Radicalism. We'll return and speak more with James Barrett about his understanding and his unearthing of this category of blue-collar cosmopolitan in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in the U.S. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. We are talking with James Barrett about his book, History from the Bottom Up and the Inside Out, Ethnicity, Race, and Identity in Working Class History. It's published by Duke University Press. Sailors, you devote a section of this chapter about what you call blue-collar cosmopolitans, intellectuals, to sailors. Did sailors read a lot?
Yeah, so the well-read sailor is partly a product, again, of kind of practical and material conditions of work. So these are men, overwhelmingly, who find themselves confined to the ship for often very long periods of time. The sailing ships, months, but even when steam comes in, you're talking about very long round-trip journeys. And that can, it doesn't necessarily in the case of any particular individual, but it can lead to more reading, if only because the time is available. Now, on some ships, there were libraries, ship libraries. The Navy did that eventually, but also some commercial ships had ship libraries. But I would say probably more often people are bringing things onto ship and then picking them up in port. There's a whole sailors' culture, of course, that develops around this kind of work. There are close relationships that develop on board. You know, ideas are exchanged. I got interested in the sailors in particular partly through working class autobiographies that I was reading. So the guy that I spent a lot of time working on, William Z. Foster, who was probably the leading figure in the American Communist Party, started out doing all different kinds of work. He was a migratory worker and a hobo and so forth. But he was also a sailor for one part of his life. And he gives a pretty good description of what life on board is like. And for him in particular, but also for a lot of the men that he was around, reading was an important part of the onboard culture. And sometimes that might have been, you know, just adventure novels. Sometimes it might have been religious tracts. At other times, though, it was political papers, working class newspapers, works of political theory and ideology. And then one other part of their experience that leads me to argue for them as sort of archetypical working class cosmopolitans is the travel, of course, and the contact in ports, not just around the United States, but, you know, really around the world.
Right. And there are some people you mention in this book who are kind of examples of people who went to ports, for example, abroad, and learned certain things by interacting from other seamen, other sailors, and just other people in foreign locations. Can you tell us perhaps about one of them?
Right. So there's a guy by the name of, surname is Reuben. His autobiography is called Reuben the Sailor. Reuben is spelled R-U-B-I-N. So this is a guy from a Jewish family in New York City. My recollection is that he grew up in Brooklyn. But signs on, actually first with the U.S. Navy, and becomes a sailor in that case roughly in the period of the First World War, but then remains a sailor for a good part of his life. And he became a reader, so that was partly why I became interested in him. He read very little before he spent so much time on ship, but then becomes a very avid reader, and he describes when they're in port of buying large numbers of books and throwing them into his duffel bag and carrying them on board. The particular part of his experience, though, that had actually more to do with travel, per se, than with reading, was his discovery of elements of a radical political perspective that he discovers on board ship, especially through his relationship with an older Irish-American sailor who had already reached this point politically and, you know, engaged him in discussion, but also in port. So, for example, he eventually becomes interested in imperialism, having seen this in action in various places. And eventually, you know, he reads Lenin's imperialism and starts thinking about it in a more formal manner. But that's not how it started. It started with ports in Africa and in South America, you know, for want of a better way of describing it, sort of seeing imperialism and colonialism, kind of formal colonialism, in action in various parts of the world. Or to take another example, he eventually recognizes the threat of fascism internationally. But he actually starts thinking about that for the first time when he comes in contact pretty early. I think this was around 1923 or so. When he comes in contact with Italian sailors, he's stuck in port for a while and strikes up a relationship with some of these guys. And they actually are the ones that tell him about Mussolini and the development of fascism and what that's likely to represent for working class people and for trade union organizations and so forth. So in the case of the sailors, many of them are well read, but it's also this element of travel that's very much a part of their working life that can also render them, at least to my mind, as more cosmopolitan.
Yeah, I think this guy's first name was Charles, Charles Rubin. And as you said, he was in a sense mentored by another sailor, an older Irish-American sailor. How, I mean, it's impossible to generalize perhaps, but I imagine there were many cases in which somebody would take somebody under their wing, and that's how this younger person would learn about the world, perhaps, or learn about politics or about radical politics.
Right. So when I read, not all, but I would say too much of the history of radicalism, when I'm reading that, it all sounds very formal and maybe not mechanistic, but certainly it's all organizational. It has to do with formal thought and how the organizations are put together and factionalism within organizations. And what I'm actually more interested in, and I seem to find it among some of these more cosmopolitan working class types, is the informal growth of radical ideas, and not just specific ideas, but kind of a more radical outlook on the world through experience and through relationships at work and, you know, with this travel abroad. So another guy that I happen to have spent a lot of time kind of working on in an autobiographical way was a guy by the name of Steve Nelson, who started out with a different name, a Croatian name. But he fits kind of nicely the description that you just suggested. He winds up coming with no formal or, I don't know, I think I would say even informal politics. He winds up in a slaughterhouse in Philadelphia. But he runs into, he's Croatian, but he runs into a Serbian guy, and there's a common language in the form of Serbo-Croatian. And this guy gradually kind of educates him, I guess you would say. But a lot of the stuff that he talks to him about is stuff that Steve Nelson is curious about. So one element of that, just as an example, was race. So there's a lot of immigrant workers in this slaughterhouse in Philadelphia, but there are also black workers. And Nelson has not run into this before in Croatia and has questions about it, especially since there seems to be different treatment of the black workers on the part of the foreman. So he asks his elder Serbian guy, this guy happened to be in the Socialist Labor Party. I'm not sure that that even matters so much which organization it was. But this guy's got a background and some background in Marxism and is reading, you know, the radical press and so forth. And so when they're sitting down eating lunch, this guy gives him tracts and newspapers and Serbo-Croatian, and he answers his questions, including, among other things, about race and the way that seems to operate within the working class population. And eventually, this probably did not happen with all workers that went through that kind of experience, but eventually Nelson joins the Socialist Labor Party and then later the Communist Party and becomes, in some ways, kind of an important leadership, leading figure within the party organization. But it started with these kinds of informal conversations at work.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song, James Barrett. He is Emeritus History Professor at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. And his very interesting book, one of his very interesting books, is History from the Bottom Up and the Inside Out, Ethnicity, Race, and Identity in Working Class History. We're really focusing just on this one chapter, and it's so rich. I mean, there's so much more we could talk about. You have a section here on Pullman porters as another example of a working class intellectual of a sort, a blue-collar cosmopolitan. Pullman porters, again, these were African-Americans who would serve people on trains, white customers on trains. And we don't have a whole lot of time to discuss Pullman porters, but I'd like to focus on, well, a couple things. One is you use the term urban cultural emissaries to describe these porters, how were they cultural emissaries?
So this argument about some degree of what I'm calling cosmopolitanism, if only by virtue of work travel, you know, who cares about that? Why should we be interested in that? But one of the things that the porters were able to do, precisely because they did move around a lot, but eventually come back to their communities, is to spread elements of culture and also, of course, of politics. So on the cultural side, for example, they carried blues, originally kind of early acoustic blues, the kind of stuff that you would have heard in the Mississippi Delta, but eventually what people came to recognize as urban blues. So one home of that is in Chicago, and it tends to be more amplified, you know, electric blues played in bars and so forth. And some of that music was first brought to the black community, in this case in Chicago, through records that these guys picked up, or vice versa, that they would pick up records in Chicago, and when they went down south or to other parts of the country, they sold these. They probably made a little bit by doing that. You know, people in some places didn't have access to these recordings, and so they might have made a little bit on each record. But what's more important is that it helped to spread a blues culture throughout the country. And then likewise, what they're probably most famous for is taking bundles of black newspapers, especially the Daily Defender in Chicago, and distributing them in the South. You know, the Illinois Central Line ran directly from Chicago down through the Delta area of Mississippi all the way down to New Orleans. And so it helped to spread black journalism, which, among other things, encouraged people to migrate and gave them migration advice. They helped to spread that through black communities along the way. And there's all kinds of irony built into this particular part of the book. But again, one of them is that workers, Pullman porters, who I think most white patrons probably thought of as servile and treated them as such, were in many ways pretty sophisticated workers. They saw a lot. They saw the weaknesses and peccadilloes of their white customers, among other things. But they also saw other black communities, came in contact with a lot of people, saw, you know, culture at a close-up level, and spent a certain amount of their time, maybe between runs, sitting around reading. So it's another reading culture. Sometimes they might have just been reading newspapers. Other times they were reading more serious kinds of literature and other kinds of texts.
Yeah, and you also write about the Pullman porters. You know, they organized themselves as a union, as the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in 1925. And by doing so, in terms of developing and spreading the consciousness about organizing and resistance that came with organizing themselves, they helped produce many of the most important black protest leaders in a new generation. So enormously important group of people. The last category you refer to in this chapter in your book, History from the Bottom Up and the Inside Out, are radicals. And this overlaps with a number of other categories, including immigrants, right? You have socialist and anarchist and communist immigrants. You refer, well, let's just take one example from this section. Tell us about Vivian Gornick and what she wrote about her upbringing in a Jewish family in the Bronx in the 1940s.
So Vivian Gornick wound up as a very prolific and, you know, fairly well-known author on a lot of different subjects. But she started out in a housing co-op, in this case I think it was the Bronx, and she grew up in a communist family. And among the many other works that she's done, she wrote a very interesting book called The Romance of American Communism. And one of the reasons I got interested in it was that it helped to capture the kind of personal experience of being in the party and what that meant, and the kind of local cultures that developed within it. So the one that she talks the most about is within this housing co-op that she grew up, and she talks about the various characters around her mother and father's kitchen table. That's where people had to sit down and talk about ideas. And it's kind of funny on one level. You know, her parents describe this guy as a great thinker, and this woman as a great political organizer. But she recognizes that the first guy, you know, drives a bakery truck, and the woman that they're referring to sits at a machine all day in a garment sweatshop. But they are thinkers. You know, she, as a kid, she sits around and listens to them. She says that they all read not just the Freiheit, which was the communist Yiddish paper, and the Daily Worker, but also the New York Times every day, so that they're very up on what's happening. And differently from a lot of other Americans, they're also very aware of what's happening internationally, because that's their perspective. And their immigrant backgrounds has something to do with that, and their political ideology has something to do with that. But for me, you know, what they represent is people doing manual work all day, and then reading continually, and taking part in fairly sophisticated, kind of serious political discussions. So it's another one of these literate, fairly sophisticated, cosmopolitan, working class cultures. This one happens to develop, not coincidentally, within the context of the Communist Party.
Okay, so Jim, we've been talking about just a chapter of your fascinating book, History from the Bottom Up and the Inside Out, about, again, blue-collar cosmopolitans, these kind of working-class intellectuals, seldom acknowledged informal histories of radical thought, your argument partly being that working-class culture may have been much more vibrant and diverse and radical than we have recognized. Can you give us a sense of what else this book contains?
Right. So sometimes I tell people that this is a collection of essays, you know, rather than a monograph, kind of solid book from beginning to end. But this kind of collection of essays, I tell people sometimes is the sort of thing they let you do as a historian when you start getting old. And these are essays that come from different parts of my work as a historian. But if there's one thing that does hold them together, one kind of argument or project that I had in mind when I put the book together, it's an effort to try to get at the more personal side of working people's lives. You know, I understand why they wind up as being more or less anonymous most of the time that we write about them. It's not always easy to sort of get down to the level of the individual and personal relationships and even emotions, which is something that very rarely comes up in kind of a materialist social history, which is very much the sort of background that I'm from. But I did try to get at this more personal side, the more, what you might call the more subjective side of working class history in a number of ways. So there's a chapter in there on that's more autobiographical. It has to do with the way I grew up and how I came to terms with issues like race and social class and how that translated into some of the work I did. So that essay, which is, it's called The Blessed Virgin Made Me a Socialist Historian, and that's very much autobiographical. But there's also two chapters on a very unlikely setting to try to do this kind of more personal work, and that is the Communist Party. So there's an essay there that's based on about 40 or 50 communist autobiographies and some interviews. And there's a chapter on this guy that I mentioned earlier, William C. Foster, on his personal narrative, weaknesses as well as strengths and what you can learn from that. The chapter that we talked about on blue-collar cosmopolitans, and then a chapter kind of in that same strain about the relationship between a semi-skilled woodworker, but a well-read woodworker and anarchist, a relationship between him on the one hand and a bohemian intellectual, a guy by the name of Hutchins Hapgood. That's an effort to try to get at, you know, it's kind of a study in social class relations within a certain kind of setting. Most of the other essays have to do with diversity within the working class population, forms of identity, you know, racial identity, the development of whiteness, and I've always been very interested in the reproduction of racism, white supremacist kind of thinking within working class populations. So I tried to get at that in an article that's called Americanization from the Bottom Up, but also in an article that I did with Dave Roediger that's called In Between Peoples, and tries to talk about the racial identity of immigrant workers, but also the ascribed identity, in other words, the way they were viewed in racial terms. And the book ends with two essays. One is drawn very much on a book that you mentioned earlier, The Irish Way, which is actually, it's too often thought of, I think, as a study of Irish Americans in particular. What I was actually interested in was relations between them and various other racial and ethnic groups. So African Americans, Chinese immigrants, and Italians and Poles and Jews and so forth. And it's an effort to try to explain the development of a distinct kind of inter-ethnic working class culture in cities that the Irish were important to, but they're not the only ones that produce it. And the book ends with a more historiographical kind of essay on the British Marxist historian E.P. Thompson and his impact on radical history in the United States, working class history in particular, but more generally the effort to sort of rewrite the history of the United States as a society kind of from the bottom up. He was a big influence on me and on the effort to do that, and so that last essay deals with that.
James Barrett, author of several books, including William Z. Foster and the Tragedy of American Radicalism, The Irish Way, Becoming American in the Multi-Ethnic City, and the book that we've been focusing on today, History from the Bottom Up and the Inside Out, Ethnicity, Race, and Identity in Working Class History. It's published by Duke University Press. James, thank you so much for writing this book and for joining us today.
I really appreciate the effort put into it and the chance to talk to an audience about all this. Thanks very much.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.